Part 2. Chapter 14. East Prussia, December 1925. The deer are starving this winter. They leave the woods and scratch about the meadows for food. The big buck is there, standing in the brilliant sunshine, nose pushing into the snow for a little frozen grass. They are behind a low hill, Anna on her belly, Papa crouching beside her. He is whispering instructions, but she does not hear him. She needs no instruction. She has waited for this day, imagined it, prepared for it. She is slipping the shells into the barrel of her rifle. It is new, the stock smooth, unscratched, and smelling of clean gun oil. It is her birthday present. Today she is 15. The deer is her present, too. She had wanted to take a deer earlier, but Papa had refused. "It is a very emotional thing, killing a deer," he had said, by way of explanation. "It's hard to describe. You have to experience it, and I won't let that happen until you are old enough to understand." It is a difficult shot, 150 meters, a brisk, icy crosswind. Anna's face stings with the cold. Her body is shuddering, her fingers have gone numb in her gloves. She choreographs the shot in her mind. Squeeze the trigger gently, just like on the shooting range, just like Papa taught her. The wind gusts. She waits. She rises onto one knee and swings the rifle into firing position. The deer, startled by the crunch of snow beneath her, raises its massive head and turns in the direction of the sound. Quickly she finds the buck's head in her sight, accounts for the crosswind, and fires. The bullet pierces the buck's eye, and it collapses onto the snowy meadow in a lifeless heap. She lowers the gun, turns to Papa. She expects him to be beaming, cheering, to have his arms open to hold her and tell her how proud he is. Instead, his face is a blank mask as he stares first at the dead buck, then at her.
"Your father always wanted a son, but I didn't give him one," Mother said as she lay dying of tuberculosis in the bedroom at the end of the hall. "Be what he wants you to be. Help him, Anna. Take care of him for me."
She has done everything Mother asked. She has learned to ride and shoot and do everything the boys do, only better. She has traveled with Papa to his diplomatic postings. On Monday, they sail for America, where Papa will be first consul. Anna has heard about the gangsters in America, racing around the streets in their big black cars, shooting everyone in sight. If the gangsters try to hurt Papa, she'll shoot them through the eye with her new gun. That night, they lie together in Papa's great bed, a large wood fire burning brightly on the hearth. Outside it is a blizzard. The wind howls and the trees beat against the side of the house. Anna always believes they are trying to get inside because they are cold. The fire is crackling and the smoke smells warm and wonderful. She presses her face against Papa's cheek, lays her arm across his chest.
"It was hard for me the first time I took a deer," he says, as if admitting failure. "I almost put down my gun. Why wasn't it hard for you, Anna, darling?"
"I don't know, Papa. It just wasn't."
"All I could see was the damn thing's eyes staring at me. Big brown eyes. Beautiful. Then I saw the life go out of them, and I felt terrible. I couldn't get the damn thing out of my mind for a week afterward."
"I didn't see the eyes."
He turns to her in the dark.
"What did you see?"
She hesitates.
"I saw his face."
"Whose face, darling?"
He is confused.
"The deer's face?"
"No, Papa, not the deer."
"Anna, darling, what on earth are you talking about?"
She wants desperately to tell him. To tell someone. If Mother was still alive, she might be able to tell her. But she cannot bring herself to tell Papa. He would go insane. It would not be fair to him.
"Nothing, Papa. I'm tired now.
She kisses his cheek. Good night, Papa. Sweet dreams. London, January 1944. It had been 6 days since Catherine Blake received the message from Hamburg. During that time, she had thought long and hard about ignoring it. Alpha was the code name of a rendezvous point in Hyde Park, a footpath through a grove of trees. She couldn't help but feel jittery about going forward with the meeting. MI5 had arrested dozens of spies since 1940. Surely some of those spies had spilled everything they knew before their appointments with the hangman. Theoretically, this should make no difference in her case. Fogel had promised her she would be different. She would have different radio procedures, different rendezvous procedures, and different codes. Even if every other spy in England were arrested and hanged, they would have no way of getting at her. Catherine wished she could share Fogel's confidence. He was hundreds of miles away, cut off from Britain by the Channel, flying blindly. The smallest mistake might get her arrested or killed. Like the rendezvous site, for example. It was a bitterly cold night. Anyone loitering in Hyde Park would automatically come under suspicion. It was a silly mistake, so unlike Fogel. He must be under enormous pressure. It was understandable. There was an invasion coming. Everyone knew it. The only question was when and where. She was reluctant to make the rendezvous for another reason. She was frightened of being drawn into the game. She had grown comfortable. Too comfortable, perhaps. Her life had assumed a structure and a routine. She had her warm flat. She had her volunteer work at the hospital. She had Fogel's money to support her. She was reluctant, at this late stage of the war, to put herself in danger. She did not regard herself as a German patriot by any means. Her cover seemed totally secure. She could wait out the war and then make her way back to Spain, back to the Grand Estancia in the foothills, back to Maria. Catherine turned into Hyde Park. The evening traffic in Kensington Road faded to a pleasant hum. She had two reasons for making the rendezvous. The first was her father's safety. Catherine had not volunteered to work for the Abwehr as a spy. She had been forced to do it. Fogel's instrument of coercion was her father. He had made it clear her father would be harmed, arrested, thrown into a concentration camp, even killed, if she did not agree to go to Britain. If she refused to take an assignment now, her father's life would surely be in danger. The second reason was more simple. She was desperately lonely. She had been cut off and isolated for 6 years. The normal agents were allowed to use their radios. They had some contact with Germany. She had been permitted almost no contact. She was curious. She wanted to talk to someone from her own side. She wanted to be able to drop her cover for just a few minutes, to shed the identity of Catherine Blake. She thought, God, but I almost can't remember my real name. She decided she would make the rendezvous. She walked along the edge of the Serpentine, watching a fleet of ducks fishing the gaps in the ice. She followed the pathway toward the trees. The last light had faded. The sky was a mat of winking stars. One nice thing about the blackout, she thought, you could see the stars at night, even in the heart of the West End. She reached inside her handbag and felt for the butt of a silenced pistol, a Mauser 635 automatic. It was there. If anything appeared out of the ordinary, she would use it. She had made one vow, that she would never allow herself to be arrested. The thought of being locked up in some stinking British jail made her physically sick. She had nightmares about her own execution. She could see their laughing English faces before the hangman placed the black hood over her head and the rope around her neck. She would use her suicide pill, or she would die fighting, but she would never let them touch her. An American soldier passed in the other direction. A prostitute clung to his shoulder, was rubbing his cock and sticking her tongue in his ear. It was a common sight. The girls worked Piccadilly. Few wasted time or money on hotel rooms. Wall jobs, the soldiers called them. The girls just took their customers into alleyways or parks and raised their skirts. Some of the more naive girls thought fucking standing up would keep them from getting pregnant. Catherine thought. Stupid English girls. She entered the trees and waited for Fogel's agent to show. The afternoon train from Hunstanton arrived at Liverpool Street Station a half hour late. Horst Neumann collected his small leather grip from the luggage rack and joined the line of passengers spilling onto the platform. The station was chaos. Knots of weary travellers wandered the terminus like victims of a natural disaster, faces blank, waiting for hopelessly delayed trains. Soldiers slept wherever they liked, heads pillowed on kit bags. A few uniformed railway policemen meandered about, trying to keep order. All the porters were women. Neumann stepped onto the platform. Small, agile, bright-eyed, he sliced his way through the dense crowd. The men at the exit had authority written all over them. They wore rumpled suits and bowler hats. He wondered if they were looking for him. There was no way they could have a description. Instinctively, he reached inside his jacket and felt for the butt of his pistol. It was there, tucked in the waistband of his trousers. He also felt for his billfold in his breast pocket. The name on his identity card read James Porter. His cover was a travelling pharmaceutical salesman. He brushed past the two men and joined the crowd jostling along Bishopsgate Road. The journey, except for the inevitable delay, had gone smoothly. He had shared a compartment with a group of young soldiers. For a time they had eyed him malevolently while he read his newspapers. Neumann guessed any healthy-looking young man not in uniform would be subjected to a certain amount of contempt. He told them he had been wounded at Dunkirk and brought back to England half-dead aboard an ocean-going tug, one of the little ships. The soldiers asked Neumann to join them in a game of cards, and he beat the pants off them. The street was pitch dark, the only light provided by the shaded headlamps of the evening traffic working its way along the road, and the pale blackout torches carried by many of the pedestrians. He felt as if he were in the midst of a child's game, trying to perform a ridiculously simple task while blindfolded. Twice he smashed straight into a pedestrian coming in the opposite direction. Once he collided with something cold and hard and started to apologize before noticing it was a lamppost. He had to laugh. London certainly had changed since his last visit. He was born Nigel Fox in London in 1919 to a German mother and an English father. When his father died in 1927, his mother returned to Germany and settled in Düsseldorf. A year later, she remarried a wealthy manufacturer named Erich Neumann, a stern disciplinarian who wasn't about to have a stepson named Nigel who spoke German with an English accent. He immediately changed the boy's name to Horst, allowed him to take his family name, and enrolled him in one of the toughest military schools in the country. Horst was miserable. The other boys teased him because of his poor German. Small, easily bullied, he came home most weekends with blackened eyes and split lips. His mother grew worried. Horst had become quiet and withdrawn. Erich thought it was good for him. But when Horst turned 14, his life changed. At an all-comers track meet, he entered the 1500 meters in his school shorts and no shoes. He finished well under 5 minutes, stunning for a boy with no training. A coach from the National Federation had watched the race. He encouraged Horst to train and convinced his school to make special provisions for the boy. Horst came alive. Freed from the drudgery of the school's physical education classes, he spent afternoons running through the countryside and the mountains. He loved being alone, away from the other boys. He was never happier. He quickly became one of the best junior track athletes in the country and a source of pride for the school. He joined the Hitler Jugend, the Hitler Youth. Boys who had picked on him years earlier suddenly were vying for his attention. In 1936, he was invited to attend the Olympic Games in Berlin. He watched the American Jesse Owens stun the world by winning 4 gold medals. He met Adolf Hitler at a reception for Hitler Youth, and even shook his hand. He was so excited he telephoned home to tell his mother. Erich was immensely proud. Sitting in the grandstand, Horst dreamed of 1944, when he would be old enough and fast enough to compete for Germany. The war would change all that. He joined the Wehrmacht early in 1939. His physical fitness and lone wolf attitude brought him to the attention of the Fallschirmjäger, the paratroopers. He was sent to paratroop school at Strandhal and jumped into Poland on the first day of the war. France, Crete, and Russia followed. He had his Knight's Cross by the end of 1942. Paris would end his jumping days. Late one evening, he went into a small bar for a brandy. A group of SS officers had taken over the back room for a private party. Halfway through his drink, Neumann heard a scream from the back room. The Frenchman behind the bar froze, too terrified to investigate. Neumann did it for him. When he pushed back the door, he saw a French girl on the table, arms and legs pinned down by SS men. A major was raping her. Another was beating her with a belt. Neumann went in on the run and delivered a brutal blow to the major's face. His head struck the corner of a table. He never regained consciousness. The other SS men dragged him into an alley, beat him savagely, and left him for dead. He spent 3 months in a hospital recovering. His head injuries were so severe he was declared unfit to jump. Because of his fluent English, he was assigned to an army intelligence listening post in northern France, where he spent his days sitting before a radio receiver in a cramped, claustrophobic hut, monitoring wireless communications originating across the channel in England. It was drudgery. Then came the man from the Abwehr, Kurt Vogel. He was gaunt and tired, and under different circumstances Neumann might have thought he was an artist or an intellectual. He said he was looking for qualified men willing to go to Britain and conduct espionage. He said he would double Neumann's Wehrmacht pay. Neumann wasn't interested because of the money. He was bored out of his skull. He accepted on the spot. That night he left France and returned to Berlin with Vogel. A week before coming to Britain, Neumann was taken to a farmhouse in the district of Dahlem, just outside Berlin, for a week of briefings and intense preparation. Mornings were spent in the barn, where Vogel had rigged a jump platform for Neumann to practice. A live jump was deemed out of the question for security reasons. He also brushed up his skills with a handgun, which were impressive to begin with, and silent killing. Afternoons were given over to the essence of field work, dead drops, rendezvous procedures, codes, and radio. At times the briefings were handled by Vogel alone. At other times he brought his assistant, Werner Ulbricht. Neumann playfully referred to him as Watson, and Ulbricht accepted it with an uncharacteristic relish. In the late afternoons, with the winter light dying over the gentle snowy landscape of the farm, Neumann was allowed 45 minutes for running. For 3 days he was permitted to go alone, but on the fourth day, his head filling with Vogel's secrets, a jeep shadowed him from a distance. Evenings were Vogel's private preserve. After a group supper in the farmhouse kitchen, Vogel would lead Neumann into the study and lecture him by the fire. He never used notes, for Vogel, Neumann could see, had the gift of memory. Vogel told him of Sean Doherty and the drop procedure. He told him of an agent named Catherine Blake. He told him of an American officer named Peter Jordan. Each night, Vogel would cover old ground before adding another level of detail. Despite the informality of the country atmosphere, his wardrobe never changed. Dark suit, white shirt, and dark tie. His voice was as annoying as a rusty hinge, yet it held Neumann with its intensity and singleness of purpose. On the sixth night, pleased with his pupil's progress, Vogel actually permitted himself a brief smile, which he quickly covered with his right hand, embarrassed by his dreadful teeth. "Enter Hyde Park from the north," Vogel had reminded him during their final meeting, "from Bayswater Road," which Neumann did now. "Follow the pathway to the trees overlooking the lake. Make one pass to make certain the place is clean. Make your approach on the second pass. Let her decide whether it will continue. She will know if it is safe. She is very good." A small man appeared on the pathway. He wore a wool overcoat and a brimmed hat. He walked briskly past without looking at her. She wondered if she was losing her power to attract men. She stood in the trees, waiting. The rules for the rendezvous were specific. If the contact does not appear exactly on time, leave and come back the following day. She decided to wait another minute, then leave. She heard the footsteps. It was the same man who had passed her a moment earlier. He nearly bumped into her in the dark.
"I say, I do seem to be a bit lost," he said,
in an accent she couldn't quite place.
"Can you point me in the direction of Park Lane?"
Catherine looked at him carefully. He wore an all-weather smile, his eyes burning bright blue beneath the brim of his hat. She pointed west.
"It's in that direction."
"Thank you." He started to walk away, then turned around. "Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully." He smiled and said,
"Catherine Blake, as I live and breathe. Why don't we go somewhere warm where we can talk?"
Catherine reached inside her purse and removed her blackout torch.
"Do you have one of these?"
she asked.
"Unfortunately, no."
"That's a stupid mistake, and stupid mistakes like that could get us both killed." Chapter 15. London. While Harry Dalton was still on the Met, he was considered a meticulous, shrewd, and relentless investigator who believed no lead, no matter how trivial, should be discarded. His big break came in 1936. Two young girls had vanished from an East End playground, and Harry was assigned to the crack team of officers investigating the case. After 3 sleepless days of digging, Harry arrested a drifter named Spencer Thomas. Harry handled the interrogation. At daybreak, he led a search party to a secluded spot along the Thames estuary, where Thomas had told him he would find the mutilated bodies of the girls. In the days that followed, he also found the bodies of a prostitute in Gravesend, a waitress in Bristol, and a housewife in Sheffield. Spencer Thomas was locked up in an asylum for the criminally insane. Harry was promoted to detective inspector. Nothing in his professional experience had prepared him for a day as frustrating as this. He was looking for a German agent, but he didn't have a single clue or lead. His only recourse was to telephone local police forces and ask for reports of anything out of the ordinary, any crime that might be committed by a spy on the move. He couldn't tell them he was looking for a spy. That would be a breach of security. He was fishing, and Harry Dalton hated fishing. The conversation Harry had with a police officer in Evesham was typical.
"What did you say your name was?"
"Harry Dalton."
"Calling from where?"
"The War Office in London."
"I see. What would you be wanting with me?"
"I want to know whether you've had any reports of crimes that might be committed by someone on the run."
"Such as?"
"Such as stolen cars, stolen bicycles, stolen ration coupons, petrol. Use your imagination."
"I see."
"Well?"
"We did have a report of a stolen bicycle."
"Really? When?"
"This morning."
"That could be something."
"Bicycles are bloody valuable these days. I had an old wreck rusting in my shed. Took it out, cleaned it up a bit, sold it to a Yank corporal for 10 quid. 10 quid? Can you believe it? That thing wasn't worth 10 shillings.
"That's interesting. What about the stolen bicycle?"
"Hold on a minute. What did you say your name was?"
"Harry."
"Harry. Hold on a minute, Harry. George, did we hear anything more about that missing bicycle up on Sheep Street?" "Yeah, that one." "What do you mean he found it? Where the hell was it?" "In the middle of the pasture? How the hell did he get there?"
"He did? Christ almighty!
You with me, Harry?"
"I'm still here."
"Sorry, false alarm."
"That's all right. Thanks for looking into it."
"No problem."
"If you hear of anything..."
"You'll be the first to know, Harry."
"Cheers."
In the late afternoon, he had fielded dozens of telephone calls from policemen in the countryside, one more bizarre than the next. An officer from Bridgewater called to report a broken window. Harry said,
"Looked like breaking and entering."
"Not really."
"Why not?"
"Because it was the stained glass window at the church."
"Right. Keep your eyes open."
The police in Skegness reported someone trying to get into a pub after hours. Harry said,
The man I'm looking for may not be familiar with English licensing laws.
I'll look into it a little harder, then.
Good. Keep in touch. He called back 20 minutes later.
It was just a local woman looking for her husband. Terrible drunk, I'm afraid.
Damn.
Sorry, Harry. Didn't mean to get your hopes up.
You did, but thanks for checking it out.
Harry looked at his watch. 4 o'clock, shift change in registry. Grace would be coming on duty. He thought, maybe I can make something out of this day. He took the lift down to registry and found her pushing a metal cart brimming with files. She had a shock of short, white blonde hair, and her cheap, blood-red wartime lipstick made her look as if she were tarted up for a man. She wore a schoolboy's grey woolen sweater and a black skirt that was a little too short. Her heavy stockings could not hide the shape of her long, athletic legs. She spotted Harry and smiled warmly. Within the world of registry, Grace was the exception. Vernon Kell, the founder of the service, believed only members of the aristocracy or relatives of MI5 officers could be trusted for such sensitive work. As a result, registry was always populated with a staff of rather beautiful debutantes. But Grace was a middle-class girl, the daughter of a schoolteacher. She spotted Harry and smiled warmly. Then, with only a sideways glance of her bright green eyes, she told him to meet her in one of the small side rooms. She joined him a moment later, closed the door, and kissed his cheek.
"Hello, Harry, darling. How have you been?"
"Fine, Grace. Good to see you."
It started in 1940, during a night raid over London. They sheltered together in the underground, and in the morning, when the all-clear sounded, she had taken him to her flat and to her bed. She was attractive in an unconventional way, and a passionate, uninhibited lover. A pleasant, convenient escape from the pressure of the office. For Grace, Harry was someone kind and gentle, who would help pass the time until her husband came back from the army. They could have carried on that way the entire war, but 3 months into the affair, Harry was suddenly overwhelmed with guilt.
"The poor sod is fighting for his life in North Africa, and I'm here in London bedding his wife."
The feelings provoked a deeper crisis for him. He was a young man. Maybe he should be in the army risking his life instead of chasing relatively harmless spies around Britain. He told himself MI5's work was vital to the war effort, indispensable, but the nagging feelings of doubt persisted. What would I do on the battlefield? Would I pick up my gun and fight, or would I cower in a foxhole? He told Grace about his feelings the next night, when he broke off the affair. They made love one last time, her kisses salty with tears. "Bloody war," she kept saying. "Lousy, bloody, awful war."
"I need a favour, Grace," Harry said, voice low.
"Listen to you, Harry. You don't call, you don't write, you don't bring me flowers. Then you pop round and say you need a favour."
She smiled and kissed him again.
"All right. What do you need?"
"I need to see the access list on a file."
Her face darkened.
"Come on, Harry. You know I can't do that."
"An Abwehr man named Fogel. Kurt Fogel."
A look of recognition flashed across her face, then dissipated.
"Grace, I don't need to tell you we're working a very important case."
"I know you're working on an important case, Harry. The whole department is buzzing about it."
"When Vickery came down to pull Fogel's file, it was missing. He went to see Jago, and 2 minutes later he had the bloody thing in his hand. Jago spun some yarn about it being mislaid."
She was angrily digging through the files on the cart. She grabbed a bunch and began replacing them on the shelves.
"I know all about it, Harry."
"How do you know?"
"Because he blamed it on me. He wrote a letter of reprimand and put it in my file, the bastard."
"Who blamed you?"
"Jago,"
she hissed.
"Why?" "To cover his arse, that's why."
She was digging through the files again. Harry reached out and took her hands in his to make her stop.
"Grace, I need to see that access list."
"The access list won't tell you anything. The person who had that file before Vickery doesn't leave a trail."
"Grace, please, I'm begging."
"I like it when you beg, Harry."
"Yeah, I remember."
"Why don't you come over for some dinner one night?"
She dragged the tip of her finger over the back of Harry's hand. It was black from sorting files.
"I miss your company. We'll talk, have a few laughs, nothing else.
I'd like that, Grace.
It was the truth. He missed her very much.
If you tell anyone where you got this, Harry, so help me God, it stays between you and me.
Not even Vickery, she insisted. Harry put his hand over his heart.
Not even Vickery.
Grace picked up another handful of files, then looked up at him. With her blood-red lips, she mouthed the initials B.B.
How is it possible you don't have a single lead?
Basil Boothby said as Vickery sank down into the deep, overstuffed couch. Sir Basil had demanded nightly updates on the progress of the investigation. Vickery, knowing Boothby's passion for having things in writing, suggested a concise note, but Sir Basil wanted to be briefed in person. Tonight, Boothby had an engagement. He had mumbled something about the Americans to explain the fact he was dressing in his formal wear when Vickery was shown into the office. While he spoke, his big paw was engaged in an abortive effort to stuff a gold cufflink through the starched cuff of his shirt. Sir Basil had a valet to assist him with such tedious tasks at home. Vickery's briefing was suspended a moment while Boothby summoned his pretty secretary to help him dress. It gave him a moment to process the information Harry had given him. It was Sir Basil who had pulled Fogel's file. He tried to remember their first conversation. What was it Boothby had said?
Registry may have something on him.
Boothby's secretary slipped quietly out. Vickery resumed his briefing. They had men watching every rail station in London. Their hands were tied because they had no description of the agents they were supposed to be looking for. Harry Dalton had compiled a list of every known location used by German agents for rendezvous points. Vickery had men watching as many of those as he could.
I'd give you more men, Alfred, but there aren't any, Boothby said. The watchers are all pulling double and triple shifts. The head of the watchers is complaining to me that you're running them into the ground. The cold is killing them. Half of them have been struck down by the flu.
I'm sympathetic to the plight of the watchers, Sir Basil. I'm using them as judiciously as possible.
Boothby lit a cigarette and sipped his gin and bitters while pacing the length of the room.
We have three German agents loose in the country outside our control. I don't need to tell you how serious this is. If one of those agents tries to contact one of our doubles, we're going to be in trouble. The whole double-cross apparatus will be in jeopardy.
My guess is they won't try to contact any other agents.
Why not?
Because I think Fogel is running his own show. I think we're dealing with a separate network of agents we never knew about.
That's just a hunch, Alfred. We need to deal with the facts.
Ever read Fogel's file? Vickery said, as carelessly as possible.
No.
And you're a liar, Vickery thought.
Judging by the way this affair has unfolded, I'd say Fogel has kept a network of sleeper agents inside Britain, on ice, since before the beginning of the war. If I had to guess, the primary agent is operating in London. The sub-agent somewhere in the countryside, where he could take in an agent on short notice. The agent who arrived last night is almost certainly here to brief the lead agent on his assignment. For all we know, they're meeting right now as we speak, and we're falling further and further behind.
Interesting, Alfred, but it's all based on guesswork.
Educated guesswork, Sir Basil. In the absence of hard, provable facts, I'm afraid that's our only recourse.
Vickery hesitated, aware of the response his next suggestion was likely to generate.
In the meantime, I think we should schedule a meeting with General Betts to brief him on developments.
Boothby's face sagged into an angry frown. Brigadier General Thomas Betts was the Deputy Chief of Intelligence at Schaeff. Tall, bear-like, Betts had one of the most unenviable jobs in London, making sure none of the several hundred American and British officers who knew the secret of Overlord gave that secret, intentionally or unintentionally, to the enemy.
That's premature, Alfred.
Premature? You said it yourself, Sir Basil. We have three German spies on the loose.
I've got to go down the hall and brief the Director General in a moment. If I suggest to him that we broadcast our failures to the Americans, he will fall on me from a very great height.
I'm sure the DG won't be too hard on you, Sir Basil. Vickery knew that Boothby had convinced the Director General that he was indispensable. Besides, it's hardly a failure. Boothby stopped pacing.
What would you call it?
A temporary setback. Boothby snorted and crushed out his cigarette.
I will not permit you to tarnish the reputation of this department, Alfred. I won't have it.
Perhaps there's something else you should consider besides the reputation of this department, Sir Basil.
What's that?
Vickery struggled out of the soft, deep couch. If the spies succeed, we may very well lose the war.
Well then, do something, Alfred.
Thank you, Sir Basil. That's certainly sound advice. Chapter 16. London. From Hyde Park, they took a taxi into Earl's Court. They paid off the driver a quarter mile from her flat. During the short walk, they doubled back twice, and Catherine made a bogus call from a phone box. They were not being tailed. Her landlady, Mrs. Hodges, was in the hall as they arrived. Catherine threaded her arm through Neumann's. Mrs. Hodges shot her a glance of disapproval as they walked upstairs. Catherine was reluctant to take him to her flat. She had jealously protected its whereabouts and refused to provide the address to Berlin. The last thing she needed was some agent on the run from MI5 to come pounding on her door in the middle of the night. But meeting in public was out of the question. They had much to discuss, and doing it in a cafe or a railway station was too dangerous. She watched Neumann as he led himself on a tour of her flat. She could tell by the precise walk and economical gestures that he had been a soldier once. His English was flawless. Clearly, Fogel had chosen him carefully. At least he wasn't sending some rank amateur to brief her. He went to the drawing-room window, parted the curtains, and gazed down into the street.
"Even if they're out there, you'll never spot them," Catherine said as she sat down.
"I know. But it makes me feel better to look." He came away from the window. "It's been a long day. I could use a cup of tea."
"Everything you need is in the kitchen. Help yourself."
Neumann set water on the stove to boil, then came back into the room.
"What's your name?" she asked him. "Your real name?"
"Horst Neumann."
"You're a soldier.
At least you used to be one. What's your rank?" "I'm a lieutenant." She smiled.
"I outrank you, by the way."
"Yes, I know. Major."
"What's your cover name?"
"James Porter."
"Let me see your identification."
He handed it across. She examined it carefully. It was an excellent forgery. She gave it back to him.
"It's good," she said. "But show it only if it is absolutely necessary. What's your cover?"
"I was wounded at Dunkirk and invalided out of the army. I'm a travelling salesman now."
"Where are you staying?"
"The Norfolk coast, a village called Hampton Sands. Focal has an agent there named Sean Doherty. He's an IRA sympathiser who runs a small farm."
"How did you enter the country?"
"Parachute."
"Very impressive," she said genuinely. "And Doherty took you in? He was waiting for you?"
"Yes."
"Focal contacted him by radio?"
"I assume so, yes."
"That means MI5 is looking for you."
"I think I spotted two of their men at Liverpool Street."
"It makes sense. They'd certainly be watching the stations."
She lit a cigarette.
"Your English is excellent. Where did you learn it?"
While he told her the story, Catherine looked at him carefully for the first time. He was small and sparingly built. He might have been an athlete once, a tennis player or a runner. His hair was dark. His eyes a penetrating blue. He was obviously intelligent, not like some of the imbeciles she had seen at the Abwehr spy school in Berlin. She doubted he had been behind enemy lines before as an agent, yet he showed no sign of nerves. She had a few more questions before she would listen to what he had to say.
"How did you end up in this line of work?"
Neumann told her the story, that he'd been a member of the Fallschirmjäger, that he had seen action in more places than he could remember. He told her about Paris, about his transfer to the Funkabwehr eavesdropping unit in northern France, and about his eventual recruitment by Kurt Fogel.
"Our Kurt is very good at finding work for the restless,"
Catherine said, when he had finished. So what does Fogel have in mind for me?
One assignment, then out. Back to Germany.
The kettle screamed. Neumann went into the kitchen and busied himself with the tea. One assignment, then out. Back to Germany. And with a highly capable former paratrooper to help her make her escape. She was impressed. She had always assumed the worst. When the war ended, she would be abandoned in Britain and forced to fend for herself. The British and the Americans, when the inevitable victory came, would pore over captured Abwehr files. They would find her name, realize she had never been arrested, and come after her. That was the other reason she had withheld so much information from Fogel. She didn't want to leave a trail in Berlin for her enemies to follow. But Fogel obviously wanted her back in Germany, and he had taken steps to make sure that happened. Neumann came back into the drawing room with a pot of tea and two mugs. He placed the things on a table and sat down again. Catherine said, "What's your job, besides briefing me on my assignment?"
"Whatever you need, basically. I'm your courier, your support agent, and your radio operator. Fogel wants you to continue to stay off the air. He's convinced it's not safe. The only time you're to use your radio is if you need me. You contact Fogel with a prearranged signal, and Fogel will contact me."
She nodded, then said, "And when it's all over? How are we supposed to get out of Britain? And please don't say something heroic like steal a boat and sail back to France, because it's not possible."
"Of course not. Fogel has arranged first-class passage for you aboard a U-boat."
"Which one?"
"U-509.
"Where?"
"The North Sea."
"It's big. Where in the North Sea?"
"Spurn Head, off the Lincolnshire coast."
"I've lived here for 5 years, Lieutenant Neumann. I know where Spurn Head is. How are we supposed to get to the U-boat?"
"Fogel has a boat and a skipper waiting at a dock along the River Humber. When it's time to leave, I contact him, and he takes us out to the submarine."
She thought, "So Fogel has a built-in escape hatch he's never told me about."
Catherine sipped her tea, inspecting Neumann over the brim of the mug. It was remotely possible he was an MI5 man posing as a German agent. She could play silly games like testing his German or asking him about some little-known Berlin café. But if he truly was MI5, he would be smart enough to avoid an obvious trap. He knew the patter, he knew a great deal about Fogel, and his story seemed credible. She decided to let it continue. As Neumann was about to resume speaking, the air raid sirens wailed.
"Do we need to take this seriously?" Neumann asked. "Did you see the building behind this one?"
Neumann had seen it, a pile of broken brick and smashed timber. "Where's the nearest shelter?"
"Around the corner."
She smiled at him.
"Welcome back to London, Lieutenant Neumann."
It was early evening the following day when Neumann's train drew into Hunstanton station. Sean Doherty was smoking anxiously on the platform as he stepped off the train.
"How did it go?"
Doherty asked as they walked to his truck.
"Went off without a hitch."
Doherty drove uncomfortably fast over the rolling, crumbling, single-lane track. It was a rattletrap van, badly in need of an overhaul by the sound of it. Blackout shades shrouded the headlamps. A dribble of pale yellow light tried vainly to illuminate the roadway. Neumann had the sensation of walking through a strange, darkened house with only a match for light. They passed through bleak, darkened villages. Holm, Thornham, Titchwell. No lights burning. Shops and cottages tightly shuttered, no sign of human habitation. Doherty was telling him about his day, but Neumann gradually tuned him out, thinking about last night. They had rushed to a tube station like everyone else and waited 3 hours on the dank platform for the all-clear to sound. She slept for a time, allowing her head to fall against his shoulder. He wondered if it was the first time she had felt safe in 6 years. He stared at her in the darkness. A remarkably beautiful woman, but there was a distant sadness, a childhood wound, perhaps, inflicted by a careless adult. She stirred in her sleep, troubled by dreams. He touched the pile of curls that lay spread across his shoulder. When the all-clear sounded, she awoke, like all soldiers in enemy territory, quickly,
eyes suddenly wide, hand reaching for the nearest weapon. In her case, it was the handbag, where Neumann assumed she kept a gun or a knife. They talked until dawn. Actually, he had talked and she had listened. She never spoke, except to correct him when he had made a mistake, or contradicted something he had said hours earlier. She obviously had a powerful mind, capable of storing immense amounts of information. No wonder Fogel had so much respect for her abilities. A grey dawn was spreading over London when Neumann slipped out of her flat. He had moved like a man leaving his mistress, sneaking small glances over his shoulder, searching the faces of passers-by for traces of suspicion. For 3 hours he weaved through London in a cold drizzle, making sudden course changes, getting on and off buses, looking at reflections in windows. He decided he was not being followed and started back to Liverpool Street Station. On the train he pillowed his head on his hands and tried to sleep. Don't fall under her spell, Fogel had playfully warned on their last day together at the farm. Keep to a safe distance. She has dark places where you don't want to go. Neumann pictured her in her flat, listening in the faint light as he told her of Peter Jordan and what she was expected to do. It was the unnerving stillness about her that struck him most, the way the hands lay folded in the lap, the way the head and shoulders never seemed to move. Only the eyes, casting around the room, back and forth across his face, up and down his body, like searchlights. For a moment he allowed himself to entertain a fantasy that she desired him. But now, as Hampton Sands vanished into the gloom behind them and the Doherty cottage appeared before them, Neumann came to a disturbing conclusion. Catherine was not looking at him that way because she found him attractive. She was deciding how best to kill him if she ever needed to. Neumann had given her the letter as he left that morning. She had placed it aside, too terrified to read it. Now she opened it, hands trembling, and read it as she lay in bed. My dearest Anna, I am relieved to hear you are well and safe. Since you have left me, all light has gone from my life. I pray that this war will end soon so we can be together again. Good night, sweet dreams, little one. Your adoring father. When she finished reading it, she carried the letter into the kitchen, touched it to the gas flame, and tossed it into the sink. It flared a moment, then quickly died away. She ran the tap and washed the black ashes down the drain. She suspected it was a forgery, that Fogel had concocted it in order to keep her in line. Her father, she feared, was dead. She went back to bed, lying awake in the soft grey light of morning, listening to the rain drumming against her window, thinking of her father, thinking of Fogel. Chapter 17. Gloucestershire, England.
Congratulations, Alfred. Come inside. I'm sorry it had to happen this way, but you've just become a rather wealthy man.
Edward Kenton thrust out his hand as if he were waiting for Vickery to impale himself on it. Vickery took the hand and shook it weakly before brushing past Kenton into the drawing-room of his aunt's cottage.
"Damned cold outside," Kenton was saying as Vickery surveyed the room.
He hadn't been here since the war, but nothing had changed.
"I hope you don't mind, but I've made a fire. The place was like an icebox when I arrived. There's tea as well, and real milk. I don't suppose you see much of that in London these days."
Vickery removed his coat while Kenton went into the kitchen. It wasn't really a cottage. That was what Matilda had insisted on calling it. It was a rather large home of Cotswold limestone, with spectacular gardens surrounded by a high wall. She died of a massive stroke the night Boothby assigned him the case. Vickery had planned to attend the funeral, but he was summoned by Churchill that morning after Bletchley Park decoded the German radio signals. He felt horrible about missing the services. Matilda had virtually raised Vickery after his own mother died when he was just 12. They had remained the best of friends. She was the only person he had told about his assignment to MI5.
"What do you do exactly, Alfred?"
"I catch German spies, Aunt Matilda."
"Oh, good for you, Alfred."
French doors overlooked the gardens, dead with winter. Sometimes I catch spies, Aunt Matilda, he thought. Sometimes they get the better of me. That morning, Bletchley Park had forwarded Vickery a decoded message from an agent in Britain. It said the rendezvous had been successful, and the agent had accepted the assignment. Vickery was growing discouraged about his chances of catching the spies. Things had worsened that morning. Two men were observed meeting in Leicester Square and brought in for questioning. The older of the two turned out to be a senior Home Office clerk. The younger man was his lover. Boothby had blown a fuse.
"How was the drive?"
Kenton asked from the kitchen over the tinkle of china and running water. "Fine," Vickery said. Boothby had reluctantly permitted him to have a rover and a driver from transport.
"I can't remember the last time I took a relaxing drive through the country," Kenton said. "But I suppose petrol and motor cars are some of the fringe benefits of your new job."
Kenton came into the room with a tray of tea. He was tall as Boothby, but with none of the bulk or physical agility. He wore round spectacles, too small for his face, and a thin moustache that looked as though it had been put there with a woman's eyebrow pencil. He set the tea down on the table in front of the couch, poured milk into the cups as though it were liquid gold, then added the tea.
"My goodness, Alfred, how long has it been?"
25 years, Vickery thought. Edward Kenton had been friends with Helen. They'd even dated a few times after Helen broke off the relationship with Vickery. By coincidence, he became Matilda's solicitor 10 years earlier. Vickery and Kenton had spoken by telephone several times over the past few years, as Matilda grew too old to manage alone, but it was the first time they had seen each other face to face. Vickery wished he could conclude his dead aunt's affairs without the spectre of Helen hanging over the proceedings. Kenton said,
"You've been assigned to the War Office, I hear."
"That's right," Vickery said, and swallowed half his cup of tea. It was delicious, much better than the swill they served in the canteen.
"What do you do exactly?"
"Oh, I work for a very dull department doing this and that." Vickery sat down. "I'm sorry, Edward, I hate to rush things along, but I really have to be heading back to London."
Kenton sat down opposite Vickery and fished a batch of papers from his black leather briefcase. Licking the tip of his slender forefinger, he guardedly turned to a suitable page.
"Ah, here we are. I drew up this will myself 5 years ago," he said. "She spread some money and other properties among your cousins, but she left the bulk of her estate to you."
"I had no idea."
"She's left you the house and quite a large amount of money."
"She was frugal.
She spent carefully and invested wisely."
Kenton turned the papers around so Vickery could read them.
"Here's what's coming to you."
Vickery was stunned. He had no idea. Missing her funeral over a couple of German spies seemed even more obscene. Something must have shown on his face because Kenton said,
"It's a shame you couldn't make it to the funeral, Alfred. It really was a lovely service. Half the county was there."
"I wanted to be here, but something came up."
"I have a few papers for you to sign to take possession of the cottage and the money. If you'll give me an account number in London, I can move the money and close her bank accounts."
Vickery spent the next few minutes silently signing his name to a pile of legal and financial documents. At the last one, Kenton looked up and said,
"Done."
"Is the telephone still working?"
"Yes, I used it myself before you arrived."
The telephone was on Matilda's writing table in the drawing room. Vickery picked up the receiver and looked at Kenton.
"Edward, if you wouldn't mind, it's official."
Kenton forced a smile.
"Say no more. I'll clear away the dishes."
Something about the exchange warmed the vindictive corners of Vickery's heart. The operator came on the line, and he gave her the number of MI5 headquarters in London. It took a few moments to get through. A department operator answered and connected Vickery to Harry Dalton. Harry answered, his mouth full of food.
"What's the fare today?" Vickery asked.
"They claim it's vegetable stew."
"Any news?"
"I think so, actually."
Vickery's heart leapt.
"I've been going over the immigration lists one more time, just to see if we missed anything."
The immigration lists were the meat and potatoes of MI5's contest with Germany's spies. In September 1939, while Vickery was still on the faculty at University College, MI5 had used immigration and passport records as the primary tool in a massive roundup of spies and Nazi sympathizers. Aliens were classified in three categories. Category C aliens were allowed complete freedom. Category B aliens were subject to certain restrictions. Some weren't allowed to own automobiles or boats, and limits were placed on their movement within the country. Category A aliens, those deemed to be a threat to security, were interned. Anyone who had entered the country before the war and could not be accounted for was assumed to be a spy and hunted down. Germany's espionage networks were rolled up and smashed, virtually overnight. A Dutch woman named Christa Kunst entered the country in November 1938 at Dover, Harry continued. A year later, her body was discovered in a shallow grave in a field near a village called Whitchurch. What's unusual about that? The thing just doesn't feel right to me. The body was badly decomposed when it was pulled out of the ground. The face and skull had been crushed. All the teeth were missing. They used the passport to make the identification. It was conveniently buried with the body. It sounds too neat to me. Where's the passport now? The Home Office has it. I've sent a courier up to collect it. It has a photograph. They say it got roughed up a bit while it was in the ground, but it's probably worth looking at. Good, Harry. I'm not sure this woman's death has anything to do with the case, but at least it's a lead. Right. How did the meeting go with the lawyer, by the way? Oh, just a few papers to sign. Vickery lied. He felt suddenly awkward about his newfound financial independence. I'm leaving now. I should be back in the office late this afternoon. Vickery rang off as Kenton came back into the drawing room.
Well, I think that about does it.
He handed Vickery a large brown envelope.
All the papers are there, as well as the keys. I've included the name of the gardener and his address. He'll be happy to serve as caretaker.
They put on their coats, locked up the cottage, and went outside. Vickery's car was in the drive.
Can I drop you anywhere, Edward?
Vickery was relieved when he declined the offer.
I spoke to Helen the other day,
Kenton said suddenly. Vickery thought, oh, good heavens.
She says she sees you from time to time in Chelsea.
Vickery wondered whether Helen had told Kenton about the afternoon in 1940 when he had stared into her passing car like some silly schoolboy. Mortified, Vickery opened the door of the car, absently beating his pockets for his half-moon glasses.
She asked me to say hello, so I'm saying it.
Hello.
Thank you. Vickery got inside.
She also says she'd like to see you sometime. Do some catching up.
That would be lovely,
Vickery said, lying.
Well, marvellous. She's coming to London next week. She'd love to have lunch with you.
Vickery felt his stomach tighten.
1 o'clock at the Connaught, a week from tomorrow, Kenton said. I'm supposed to speak with her later today. Shall I tell her you'll be there?
The back of the Rover was cold as a meat locker. Vickery sat on the big leather seat, legs covered in a travelling rug, watching the countryside of Gloucestershire sweep past his window. A red fox crossed the road, then darted back into the hedge. Drowsy fat pheasants pulled at the cropped remains of a snowy cornfield. Feather coats puffed out against the cold. Bare tree limbs scratched at the clear sky. A small valley opened before him. Fields stretched like a rumpled patchwork quilt into the distance. The sun was sinking into a sky splashed with watercolour shades of purple and orange. He was angry with Helen. His spiteful half wanted to believe his job with British intelligence somehow made him more interesting to her. His rational half told him he and Helen had managed to part as friends, and a quiet lunch might be very pleasant. At the very least, it would be a welcome diversion from the pressure of the case. He thought, what are you so afraid of? That you might remember you were actually happy for the 2 years she was part of your life? He pushed Helen from his mind. Harry's news intrigued him. By instinct, he attacked it like a problem of history. His area of expertise was 19th-century Europe. He won critical acclaim for his book on the collapse of the balance of power after the Congress of Vienna. But Vickery had a secret passion for the history and myth of ancient Greece. He was intrigued by the fact that much scholarship on the age had to be based on guesswork and conjecture. The immense passage of time and lack of a clear historical record made that necessary. Why, for example, did Pericles launch the Peloponnesian War with Sparta that eventually led to the destruction of Athens? Why not accept the demands of his more powerful rival and revoke the Megarian decree? Was he driven by fear of the superior armies of Sparta? Did he believe war was inevitable? Did he embark on a disastrous foreign adventure to relieve pressure at home? Now Vickery asked similar questions about his rival in Berlin, Kurt Vogel. What was Vogel's goal? Vickery believed Vogel's goal was to build a network of elite sleeper agents at the outset of the war and leave them in place until the climactic moment of the confrontation. In order to succeed, great care would have to be given to the way the agent was inserted into the country. Obviously, Vogel had done this. The mere fact that MI5 had no knowledge of the agent until now confirmed it. Vogel would have to assume immigration and passport control records would be used to find his agents. Vickery would certainly assume that if the roles were reversed. But what if the person who entered the country was dead? There would be no search. It was brilliant. But there was one problem. It required a body. Was it possible they actually murdered someone to trade places with Christa Kunst? Germany's spies, as a rule, were not killers. Most were money grubbers, adventurers, and petty fascists, poorly trained and financed. But if Kurt Vogel had established a network of elite agents, they would be better motivated, more disciplined, and almost certainly more ruthless. Was it possible one of those highly trained and ruthless agents was a woman? Vickery had handled only one case involving a woman, a young German girl who managed to get a job as a maid in the home of a British admiral. "Stop in the next village," Vickery said to the Wren driving the car. "I need to use the telephone." The next village was called Aston Magna. A hamlet, really. No shops, just a clump of cottages bisected by a pair of narrow lanes. An old man was standing along the roadway with his dog. Vickery wound down the window and said, "Hello."
"Hello."
The man wore Wellington boots and a lumpy tweed coat that looked at least 100 years old. The dog had 3 legs. "Is there a telephone in the village?" Vickery asked. The man shook his head. Vickery swore the dog was shaking its head too.
"No one's bothered to get one yet."
The man's accent was so broad, Vickery had trouble understanding him.
"Where's the nearest telephone?"
"That'll be in Morton."
"And where's that?"
"Follow that road there past the barn. Go left at the manor house and follow the trees into the next village. That's Morton."
"Thank you."
The dog barked as the car sped away. Vickery used the telephone at a bakery. He munched a cheese sandwich while he waited for the operator to connect him with the office. He wanted to share a little of his newfound wealth, so he ordered 2 dozen scones for the typists and the girls in registry. Harry came on the line. Vickery said,
"I don't think it was Christa Kunst they dug out of that grave in Whitchurch."
"Then who was it?"
"That's your job, Harry. Get on the phone with Scotland Yard. See if a woman went missing about the same time. Start within a 2-hour radius of Whitchurch, then go wider if you have to. When I get back to the office, I'll brief Boothby."
"What are you going to tell him?"
"That we're looking for a dead Dutch woman. He'll love that."